begin this evening's question period. Nature abhors a vacuum. They managed to get through all the questions last night, and the basket is full again. Which is good. That's a great time. That's a good question. One of my lay insight meditation teachers said, the Western lay practitioner is an experiment in Buddhism. What do you think? To me, it seems our lay teachers are also an experiment. Seems to be some bias there. Well, certainly in the West, and the predominant mode is certainly lay practice and lay teachers so far, although there's an increasing amount of interest in people wanting to study with monastic teachers, and there's certainly a strong interest in monastic training. It's just the monastic presence is still pretty tiny, really. But certainly at Abhayagiri, we've almost always have a waiting list for people who want to come and train, there's a for the nuns from our community, there's a plan for them to come establish a place, and there's a lot of people waiting patiently, so that there's so the classic model is certainly the monastic sangha, being the laying the foundation for example and teaching leadership. I think there's oftentimes there's a false dichotomy perceived from the West, in this that there's a lot of because the monastic presence is so strong in Asia, then oftentimes I think people overlook the strength of the tradition of lay practice and lay teachers in Asia, certainly in Thailand, very much the case. There's lay men, lay women who are excellent scholars, teachers, it's not as monochromatic as people might perceive. So I think it's certainly the model that the Buddha himself gave was the. It's like the there's this a very interesting discourse where. Mara comes right after the Buddha is enlightened, and So, okay, well, you've done your work. Good time to pack it in. You can die now. And the Buddha sort of says, no, it's my function and purpose to teach, and I won't pass away until the bhikkhus, say the monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen are well established in the path and the fruits, and able to give leadership and solve problems and be able to stand alone, on their own, so this dhamma and discipline can last for a long time. And that was the Buddha's, his standard of what was a balanced, strong sasana or dispensation. It was when monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen were both knowledgeable and well practiced. So. Would you comment on the last eight lines of the Buddha's words on loving kindness? I was saving that for tomorrow. So, that was a quick one. Okay, this is a common scenario. I'm caught in a story of praise and blame. I notice. A voice says, that was very quick. You're getting good at this. I wake up again. Ah, I know you, Mara. A voice says, excellent. What a skillful yogi you are becoming. I wake up yet again, etc. Mara seems to co-opt every moment of awakening to feed the ego. Do I patiently endure, and this will dissipate with time and practice, or is there something you can suggest? Well, it's both in the sense of that patient endurance is it's really hard to underestimate how important patient endurance is to the practice. That willingness to bear with the pathetic nature of the mind. But then also those experiments in undermining the perceptions of self, ego, that recollection. Okay, well, really sort of impermanence, uncertainty, change. Okay, these are mental states arising and ceasing. That's a tuning it into dhammas arising and ceasing, as opposed to me struggling with Mara, me being the champion over Mara, me being defeated by Mara again, sort of me and Mara. Dhammas arising and ceasing. That's all it is. There isn't a me in that. So it's a really important aspect of insight to be turning attention towards. Also the deconstructing of the whole process of how the thoughts arise and cease, that sense of feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness, that desire, attachment, clinging, that process of dependent origination, the process of the, it's just these five khandhas that are arising and ceasing, and being able to rest in that, the awareness of those five khandhas, as opposed to the buying into the story of, yeah, me and my khandhas. The loving-kindness chant includes, may I abide in freedom from affliction. And why is affliction not included in the wish for all beings, while hostility, ill will, anxiety are in both? The reason is because in that chant, it's actually just a little bit further down. I can't remember how it's translated, but that particular chant is the chant that is all the Brahma-viharas, loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And the wish for may all beings be free from affliction, what's it called? 34, then it's that is the expression of compassion. So that, yeah, it's may all beings be released from all suffering. So that is how that is expressed, because that's the fundamental expression of compassion, is that wish. The wish for loving-kindness aspiration is that wish for happiness and well-being, and the expression of compassion is the wish for freedom from suffering. so that, and for some reason in the chant of the loving-kindness one, then that is folded in as a, because sometimes it's difficult to find a hard and a fast distinction between the two. So that in order to experience well-being, then of course one does need to be free from suffering. This question, when we have a retreat work period that requires us to leave a sitting after 15 or 30 minutes, should we come to the meditation hall and leave early, or just practice elsewhere for that period? I think if something is it's part of a work, I don't know, not sure when that happens, in early morning or other times, how often that happens. And that when it's part of the sort of service to the community and helping the retreat, then I think it's quite all right to come to the meditation hall, leave early. It is complicated by these doors. they are not ideal. they remind me of Abhayagiri in the early years. But for when it's an, because it's probably not more than one or two people. And it's not a constant flow, so that too, I think that's quite all right to leave early. But do try to be as quiet as possible. I was thinking, like this afternoon, decided to sort of extend just the sitting, and that was it might be useful if I do that again. I'm not quite sure what I'll feel like tomorrow, but if I do that again and extend that, if people could say make a decision to if you want to go out and walk, then to go ahead and do that for the whole period, and if you make a decision to sit, then to sit for the whole period. And it's quite all right to quietly shift posture or whatever if it's necessary. But yeah, these doors don't really facilitate the going in and out too comfortably. Could always check and see if there's some WD-40 as well. I know having been involved in building a monastery, it's not as simple as WD-40, because it's hinges, doorknobs. I remember one time just this past year in Thailand, going to a house, and going in, and it was like, you turn the knob, wow, that's a good doorknob. Wow. Boy, I wish we had something like that at the monastery. This morning, you spoke about bringing to mind the metta nimitta, and metta object. I have some understanding of the feeling of metta, but no understanding of the metta nimitta. Could you explain more fully? It's exactly the same. Nimitta is not is more of a generic term of the object, and whether it expresses itself as a. Oftentimes, we associate nimitta with sometimes like a light or an image, right, a sort of image, oftentimes with mindfulness of breathing, then there'd be encouragement to, and concentration, there'd be encouragement to develop that kind of sign of light or imagery. But the actual word nimitta just means sign, and so that the sign of metta is the feeling, the actual feeling, emotion, within the heart, within experience. It's in that is the nimitta. And it is important to attend to that, in the sense that if one's looking for something else or trying to just repeating the phrases and sort of, well, this is the the metta nimitta, or even trying to conjure up an image of oneself being suffused with loving kindness somehow. That's the sign or the tangible object that is the basis for unification, and one's able to absorb into is the feeling. So that as one experiences and nurtures that, then one can allow the mind to unify with that feeling, and that's how it expands and stabilizes. Can you speak about working with fear and loss of ego identity, fear and death? that's actually where, say, loving kindness is a very skillful meditation and exercise. Because we're again that sense of fear is it's very easy to come up with that, say that, yeah, the loss of the familiar, the loss of the uncertainty of where to place one's attention, what can one trust. As one starts to see, the body, can't rely on that. Feelings, perceptions, thoughts, completely untrustworthy. Consciousness, not a good deal. and then you look at the world around. So that it's easy to say, wow, everything is just so unstable and uncertain. But and there can be a fear there, uncertainty, a certain confusion, and that discombobulation. And that ability to recognize, well, even if that is completely uncertain and impermanent, this particular feeling, that's trustworthy. I've experienced that. I've seen that. That's a true feeling within the heart. Say the confidence that arises in in just virtue, or all of the things that the Buddha encourages. There isn't anything that the Buddha encourages that is somehow something to be looked on at askance. In the sense, wow, is this untrustworthy? Mm. When you start recognizing, it's like on a certain level, one approaches the teachings and say like in the morning chanting, and sort of birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, death is dukkha, separation is dukkha, association is dukkha, everything is dukkha. And you say, wow, this is a miserable teaching. But when one looks at, that's a teaching or a perspective or a reflection. But then when one investigates, well, what does the Buddha encourage to do? What is he actually encourage you to do? What's he lay out as a path of practice and training? Then you start to, well, Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention. Okay, association with wisdom. Right speech, right action, right livelihood, just virtue. Right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Just peaceful, tranquil states of mind. Well, that's all good. And so that the path is all completely associated with the wholesome, the skillful, the uplifting, or the aspects of other qualities that the Buddha say the qualities that are conducive to passing over, say the paramitas, those qualities which are conducive to transcending, passing over, to crossing over that suffering, and it's all generosity, virtue, patience, effort, resolution, loving kindness, equanimity, wisdom, everything that's one could conceive of that is really good. That's what the Buddha encourages, and that's what forms the basis for that ability to cross over. The heart is replete with well-being and stability, so that that recollection and reminding oneself of those what the Buddha encourages us to do and cultivate, to develop, and those are all exceedingly beneficial things, bright states of mind, and those aspects of fear that come up, then it's helpful to be able to recognize, well, where does that come from? Of course, it comes from that identification with self, identification with ego, identification with body, identification with mind, identification with the world, identification with, and things that we have pretty much no control over. When one looks at it quite clearly, as he realizes, well, I really have very limited control. It's actually a very practical teaching to allow us to approach those things, which are, it's quite natural in the human condition to be dismayed at the loss of the threat to a sense of self and ego. There's a wonderful quote by Ajahn Mahabua speaking about Ajahn Mun, and said where normally, human beings, we respond to respond to teachings on liberation and nibbana with a curious sense of fear and trepidation, I don't want to go there. Oh, God, I don't want to do that. There's nothing there. But there. And It says, whereas they, you know, they are sort of parents and grandparents of, you know, all taught us quite well to, you know, attach to family, attach to possessions, attach to position, attach to, so that's our conditioning. So as the conditioning changes, then there's inevitably there's a shift that takes place. Right? It's important to be recollecting back on, well, what does the Buddha actually encourage us to do? And say, oh, okay, this is good stuff. Okay. Could you talk about opportunities for women who wish to practice in the monastic tradition? There, as I just mentioned, particularly in Ajahn Chah's lineage, then the community of nuns is established in England, and they are in the process of starting something up here in the west coast of probably around the Bay Area. So that's a opportunity that's arising in our tradition. There's beginnings of communities in a few places. We just had a Buddhist monastic conference in Shasta Abbey, which we have pretty much every year. And there's starting to be some communities, a Tibetan community starting in the East Coast. There's a community in the North Carolina, Ayatata Loka here in the Bay Area. So there's slowly starting to be more opportunities for women who are interested in monastic practice. And that, I think that's, again, in the same way that there's a tiny presence of male monastics, but a lot of interest, similar. And I'm sure that there's a lot of interest for women who want to, at least, if not to ordain, at least to draw close to female monastics. Yeah, the monastic form is in America, in particular, I think the nature of Americans who are going to go and do it on their own first in their own way, and I think there's a lot more people saying, well, maybe that monastic form that's been around 2,500 years might have some value to it. Okay, I'm not sure within the context of this retreat when to be resting simply with the four foundations of mindfulness and when to be reciting metta phrases. Can you please advise as to how/when to skillfully move from one practice to the other? The context of how I've been presenting the build metta retreat, recognizing how metta is a part of a spectrum of practices that are the Buddha's teachings. And certainly the four foundations of mindfulness, I think, are an overarching framework to be attending to. And the there's a there's a discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha talks about the establishing the mindfulness on, say, a particular skillful or wholesome thoughts, and being able to hold that exclusively for a day or a night, or a day and a night, and being able to just establish the mind in that, recognizing, discerning what's skillful, what's unskillful, and then committing to those, just those wholesome thoughts for a period. But then, he says, but then the mind gets tired. So that, and it's necessary to return to a place of stillness or stability, or so that the one has to recognize, engage, because by the say the reciting of the metta phrases is a it is a recitation. It's using a thought process, and by its very nature, it's easy for it to become repetitious and feel tiring to the mind. And it's also, and again, it's important to emphasize that the recitation of those phrases is to be used as a recollection and a reminder of the actual feeling. And as one establishes that feeling, which is non-discursive, then the mind can stay with that. But the recitation is a helpful tool to keep the mind within the bounds of the metta, the loving kindness perception. But if one is continuing to use that, and the feeling is not so strong that one can rest in that in a non-discursive way, then it's important to rest the mind in an object of, say, within the four foundations of mindfulness: body, feeling, mind, object of mind. In some way, body, of course, is an immediate, non-discursive object that the mind can rest in, relax in, bring that settling quality through the body and mind. And when the mind is refreshed, then it can go back to the recitation to keep developing that, keep trying to stabilize the perception of the feeling. So one can work with them back and forth. And it's there's no hard and fast rule: 20 minutes of this, 20 minutes of this, an hour of this. But it's more like, okay, what's the result? What's the state of the mind? What is going to be useful for settling and stilling? Okay. Okay, this is, it's great, people are reading this. One of the last lines of the Metta Sutta is, by not holding to fixed views, what does this mean? And again, that's part of that last bit of the sutta that I was planning on addressing tomorrow. It seems that metta would be much easier without a self to protect. How does one realize anatta? And so, which is excellent in the sense that the it is that and that's one of the things that's really, you know, as an insight, one starts realizing, yeah, the obstruction to metta is actually not anger and ill will and all. I mean, it is, but it's that sense of self, and that's the big obstruction. And as we reflect, investigate, and start having a clearer insight into the nature of Dhamma, the nature of teachings, and what the Buddha is giving as a opportunity for liberation, then that loving kindness is a natural expression of the non-self aspect of the Dhamma. Yeah, and the cultivation of metta would be a lot easier without the self. What is upekkha, equanimity, and how does one practice it? The upekkha is the equanimity and evenness of the mind being in a perfect balance, sense of recognition of the practice of equanimity is traditionally how it's described. The basis for equanimity is understanding the nature of karma, so that and that's, say, in the chants that we do, all beings are the owners of their karma, heir to their karma, born with their karma, related to their karma, abide supported by their karma. Whatever karma they shall do, for good or for ill, of that they will be the heir. So that in that sense of equanimity is being able to recognize that the whatever anybody's experiencing is because of the causes and conditions that have been laid down. And it's, and one of the, say, the stain or the enemy of equanimity is indifference. Right? So that, let's say, it's an ability to be very steady and clear, but be in a place of equipoise and balance. One recognizes that the way things work is through causes and conditions, and there's not a self involved in it. There's not a individual. It's these collections of causes and conditions that the habit of mind is to go to this person, that individual, our preferences, our likes, our dislikes, and that personality, but stepping back in a place of equanimity is really being able to see there's causes and conditions. So one is not shaken by anything. But it is important to recognize that indifference is not equanimity. The Brahma-viharas are not separate individual things. Like, you only have equanimity because you've given up on loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy. it's like, because that loving kindness and compassion is exceedingly strong and stable, then one has increased understanding and insight, so that one's able to rest in a place of complete stability and not be shaken by anything, because one sees, oh, this is the nature of things. It all arises through causes and conditions. So that reflection on karma and that all beings are, we inherit the karma that we have, and there's not a sort of a personality, a me or mine, and it's not fixed. It isn't as if something happens and then that's sort of inevitable, sort of immutable. State of being that's going to exist forever, but it's everything's in a state of change. Everything can change. Even patterns and circumstances, they can all change. And one can, and as one recognizes has a much clearer insight into the nature of causes, why causes and conditions, or what causes and conditions are functioning, then one has an opportunity to put attention onto the place where it's going to make the most difference. Okay. What is the most fun part about being a monk? I can assure you it's not fun. No. It's like eating and sleeping. It's very ordinary. probably in terms of the most sort of delight or joy that comes is the opportunity to meet accomplished beings, pure beings. That's the, right, that's one of the, you know, terms of fun for a monk. The opportunity to draw close to people, or to serve them, or to be in situations where one has contact. So that you get to meet some exceptional beings. What does it mean, the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings in the recollection of the Sangha? It's a way of classification with the in terms of entry into the noble paths or into realization. And there's four stages of realization: stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and fully enlightened being, arahant, sotapanna, sakadagami, anagami, arahant. And so there's four, and then there's a path and fruition, so that those who are on the path to stream entry and its fruition, those who are on the path to once returner and its fruition, those who are on the path to non-returning and its fruition, those who are on the path to arahantship and its fruition, so that there's those are the four pairs, and then the eight kinds of noble beings, so that and there's a, say, in the commentarial tradition, the way they line it up is that the actual path and fruition are tied to each other, so that it's there's the the realization of the path, and then it's within a very short time, mind moments, and then there's the realization of the fruition. There's a few discourses in the canon that make it clear, the suttas, where the description is certainly somebody who is on the path, it could be a long period of time, years even, before there's a fruition. So that's and to me that's makes much more sense. And the so that the sutta tradition, I think, is probably a much clearer description, that there's those who are sort of, they've got an insight into what is the path, what's the practice, what the actual goal is, but they have still to have that full realization of that, and it could be a very very quick insight and realization, or it could take time for that to come to fruition. So that's four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. It is a bit mysterious when you're chanting it. Yeah. Okay. What are the general Theravadan monastic community's thoughts on S.N. Goenka's meditation techniques and Vipassana centers? the techniques, it's very, they're very, very good, very useful, very helpful for focusing. The centers are great because they're all run on Dana. It's a tremendous example. And generally, they're within the sphere that of people that I know. Then encourage people to, if they want to do retreats, those are great retreats to tap into. There's, say, within our community, or some of the communities that I know of, monastic, say, Theravada monastic communities, and there is a certain hesitation with the exclusivity that tends to sort of build around that, and the there's a tendency to be very, very focused on technique and then not really get a broader perspective on what's the actual teachings of the Buddha. So that's a concern that comes up. But generally, the general say encouragement, and I've never sort of heard anybody say don't ever go to a Goenka retreat sort of thing. There are there is a certain sort of feeling that comes across sometimes of that exclusivity. Okay, last question. When doubt is mentioned under the hindrances, is it mainly referring to doubt about the Buddha's teachings? Are there other implications? Oftentimes, that's, say, when one reads the texts and commentaries, then inevitably it talks about doubt about the Buddha's teachings. And I say, most of the teachers that I know don't narrow it down that much, because it's in terms of the a hindrance, a nirvana, a quality of mind that obstructs the fundamental goodness of the mind, then it isn't just doubt about the Buddha's teachings. It's the tendency to doubt, to waver. And of course, when you doubt, waver, uncertain, then you're going to focus, the focus will be on the teachings. But you'll tend to doubt everything else as well, so that the being able to get a handle on doubt, how it's how it plays itself out in day-to-day life, doubt and uncertainty, wavering, it's really interesting just to really watch on a day-to-day basis how does it play out. Should I have two of those fruit, or should I just have one? Well, it can turn into a moment of all of us. Everything stops. Oh dear! Should I do this or do that? Should I go forward or go back? I mean, we start to doubt everything. So doubt can creep into everything, and then it manifests in the teachings as well. Doubting the teachings, doubting the practice, doubting oneself. Can one do it? Can one not do it? Am I able to? Is there any point to even doing this? I'm not sure if I can do this. It was doubt. All it is doubt. So that being able to recognize doubt as doubt. Okay, that's all it is. And then one can go forward. That that's also where mindfulness of the body is really helpful, in the sense that you're never going to talk yourself into a resolution of doubt through the mind. You'll never get everything figured out enough to not doubt, if doubt is the underlying sort of fallback position. So that the recognition of how doubt manifests as a feeling of uncertainty, a feeling of hesitation, a feeling of discomfort around a particular decision, doing something, then to be able to then cut through that and just move forward. And sometimes it's helpful to make a wrong decision, do something, but at least not to be caught in wavering and uncertainty, just to, as a part of training, because that sort of that sense of wanting to be absolutely sure that one's doing something right before doing it, you paralyze yourself and tie yourself up in knots. So that just being able to being willing to cut through and move forward, and that one can feel that in the body. That's helpful to just move forward, do it, and not get caught in doubt. Okay, managed to get through that whole stack. We have a short break and come back with for evening chanting.